You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
This episode of Desert Island Dishes is brought to you in partnership with the independent, family-run butcher, H.G. Walter. Now, I'm particularly excited about this because for over 10 years, I have been a customer of H.G. Walter for both my cooking jobs and also for at home too. They are one of the most respected butchers in the UK, supplying some of the best chefs and restaurants in the country. So it's quite cool to know that you are getting restaurant quality meat at home. And I know I've said this a million times before, but if you start with good ingredients, your life as a cook is so much easier. You barely have to do anything for it to taste delicious. And we know that good quality meat is more important than ever. If you're anything like me, you are thinking more and more about the provenance of the food you eat. And so having a butcher you can trust like H.G. Walter is just a very comforting thing. Also, never underestimate the knowledge of a butcher. If you don't know how to cook something, ask when you're in there. They know so much, they can advise about cooking times, the weight you need, and they'll always have delicious ideas for how they like to serve something. I found this kind of information absolutely invaluable when I was starting out as a chef, so I am thrilled to be telling you all about H.G. Walter today. They're based in London, but they deliver nationwide, and you can find out more at www.hgwalter.com. Thank you very much. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their 7 desert island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, how is everyone? Today's episode is an extra long one, but honestly, I could have chatted to David all day and it was really hard to cut bits out. This was the first time I had met David, but genuinely, it felt like I was talking to an old friend. David is one of those rare people who is unbelievably successful, one of the most famous photographers of our time, but very modest and completely down to earth. I loved hearing his story, from his thoughts on photography, how he got started, how he first met Jamie Oliver, which is quite the story. And I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. My guest today is David Loftus. David is one of the most influential photographers of all time, often fondly referred to as Lord Loftus. Award-winning and internationally acclaimed, David has done the photography for the books of Jamie Oliver, Rachel Khoo, Gennaro Contaldo, Elizabeth David, and April Bloomfield. For over 20 years, David has photographed over 150 books, including all but one of Jamie Oliver's international bestsellers. His work with Jamie Oliver alone has resulted in book sales of over 30 million copies. You will have looked at David's photographs, even if you were unaware of it at the time. Because of all of this, you may well be forgiven for thinking David's speciality is food and food alone. But the truth is, he also shoots fashion, portraits, landscapes, and reportage for the likes of Red Magazine, Condé Nast Traveler, Soho House, to name just a few. Together with Hipstamatic, he's developed the most successful downloadable camera pack to date, known as the Loftus Lens. His stripped-back, fuss-free style of photography has won David numerous awards over the years, and he's been described as the 65th most influential photographer of all time. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
You were sort of wincing as I did that. Do you find it uncomfortable listening back to everything you've
achieved?
I do.
I have the worst imposter syndrome known to man. So,
do you?
So hearing things like that. And the 65th thing, I honestly, when I was initially told, I thought it was a complete joke.
Did you?
I thought I was listening to a prank call.
Did you get a phone call about it?
I did. And it was very sweet. And you know, it was from Professional Photographer magazine, which is obviously, as a professional, you look at it as a bit of a Bible. But so it was, they were quite highfalutin people who were deciding on this list. But I was between other people who I just, they were my heroes, you know, growing up. So it was very strange.
Who was your biggest hero growing up?
Probably Sebastiano Delgado at that point. And he was next to me in the list. But then I looked at the list and it was actually a journalist phoned me up and wanted to talk about it. And he said, you do realise there were only, I think there were only five living Englishmen on the list. And I just thought it was nuts.
Also, when I read that, that was back in 2010. So I think you will have climbed the ranks even more so, which is incredible.
I did quite enjoy that Rankin was in at 100.
I was.
That gave me a certain amount of...
Very satisfying.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we were arranging this recording, there was a slight delay in your response one time, and then you came back and explained that you'd been shooting in the Californian desert, which was perhaps the coolest explanation I've ever received. How much of the year do you spend away on location?
It really depends. I mean, I do travel a huge amount, but I'm sort of homebod, so I do race home again as soon as I've finished. I don't sort of have any downtime. So I whiz away and, you know, if there's a week between shoots, I'll come home rather than carry on.
Yeah. Have you always been that way?
Yes. I like family and friends, so I need that in my life. Mm. So I do return. So there's a lot of travel and the desert at the moment, for some reason, is... that's every 3 months.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I go backwards and forwards.
For the same job?
It's two different clients.
Okay.
The lovely thing about being in the States is that I'm not a food photographer at all in the States. So it's all portraits and landscapes and amazing architecture. Doing a lot around Palm Springs and Rancho Mirage and places like that. Very glamorous.
Yes, very
glamorous. And I work with this fantastic little design group, Robin and John, and they're English. And they're very Palm Springs. They drive a white Corvette, dress all in black, and have bleached white Mohicans. And,
oh, wow.
And, so I feel like, you know, the cool cat in the desert.
Yeah, that is achingly cool.
In fact, I was shooting cool cats last week. I was shooting cheetahs.
Oh, really?
It was people and their pets, people and their exotic pets, which sounds
nuts.
Who
has a cheetah?
There was a wonderful lady who sponsored two rescue cheetahs. So she has these two cheetahs that were rescued from poachers.
Oh, wow. Do they live with her at home?
No, they're in a place called the Living Desert.
Okay. At the end of this podcast, we are going to send you to a desert island. How does the thought of that make you feel?
Pretty good, actually.
Yeah?
Not bad. I spend quite a lot of time in the Bahamas, and there's one little tiny island that I sometimes sit on and imagine myself being... marooned.
Oh, yeah.
And luckily I've spent a lot of my time around people who've taught me about food and survival and foraging and all those things. So as long as there are the bits there.
Okay.
It'd be the worst thing would be to find yourself on a desert island and find there are no trees and no shrubs and nothing edible.
That would be quite bad. I think this is a shrubby one.
It's a shrubby one, full of coconut trees. And
definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Papaya trees, hopefully.
Yeah, that would be the dream. Let's talk about the first desert island dish. What's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood?
So I grew up as an identical twin, as you probably know. And we had quite competitive eating habits.
Did you?
Yeah. So being identical, you always wanted to be slightly different. Mm-hmm. So you'd pick the opposite cereal or the opposite dessert or the opposite. For example, John, my twin, always had baked beans on his main course. And it didn't matter what it was, whether it was spaghetti bolognese or it was a steak. You know, he'd always ask for half a tin of Heinz baked beans on the side.
Okay.
To the point that actually when he was in his 20s and he went to the Lord Mayor's banquet, we always got on very well with waiting staff. And we were always taught by our father to be almost treat them as best friends. It's a good way to go through life.
Definitely.
It's a life lesson. Mm. Treat your waiter as your best friend. And, you know, every meal is a joy.
Yeah.
And he turned around and the guy at the Lord Mayor's show said, he noticed John wasn't eating his dinner. And he actually wasn't feeling very well. And John said, well, normally I have some baked beans on the side of my side. And 10 minutes later, half a tin of Heinz baked beans turned up.
Oh, my goodness.
At the Lord Mayor's banquet, and he was poured out the Heinz baked beans. But at breakfast, we used to have different cereals, and then we'd build a wall of cereal boxes. Mm-hmm. We were quite a big family, and we'd have a wall between us, and we'd try and look at each other which one was eating, but we'd always be eating a different cereal.
Did you ever order the baked beans just to try and confuse everyone as to who was who?
I'll be honest, baked beans didn't really enter my life until after he died.
Okay.
And then I started eating baked beans. Mm. And in fact, at a book launch a few years ago, I was asked by Carousel, you know, lovely Carousel, which is one of my favourite places. And I was asked what to serve the guests at the book launch, and I had them serve baked beans.
Oh, that's
lovely.
And
it was so sweet. It was so sweet. And, of course, everyone likes baked beans.
Yeah.
You know,
everyone's going to be happy
with
that.
They're sweet comfort food.
They are.
But probably the dish that reminds me most is probably rice pudding, which is so unfashionable. But he would stir in some raspberry jam and I'd have apricot jam.
I would.
And he'd stir it in a anti-clockwise.
Stop.
And I would stir it in a clockwise. Stop. I mean, I know it sounds really OCD, but it wasn't. It was just this sort of competitive, you know, I'm different.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I've never heard that before.
Because we were always muddled, and we hated the fact that...
Did you?
Yeah, so he would be called David, I'd be called John, and you secretly always thought, but we're so different, so different.
Did you have very different personalities?
No.
No.
First time I ever saw myself, I was interviewed on television, the first time I saw myself interviewed was after he died, and I found it so upsetting because what I realised was that we were so similar and all our little mannerisms and, you know, tone of speech and little ways we moved our hands and lips and everything was exactly the same. I always thought they were completely different.
It's amazing. Yeah. And you spend so much more time looking at a sibling than you do it yourself, obviously.
You do.
So it's a very strange thing to actually see yourself.
Plus, I don't really look in mirrors. After he died, I stopped looking in mirrors. I don't shave. It was partly why I stopped shaving. Mm. I hate looking in a mirror because I started seeing those little similarities. So as a result, I very rarely look in a mirror.
Yeah.
And when you see a photo, I'm always horrified.
No, David, you told me about your birthday earlier and no one would believe that you've just had a significant birthday. You have written a cookbook, which, of course, you shot yourself, and you are very famously very good friends with Jamie Oliver and have shot some of the best cookbooks in the world. How do you personally feel about food?
I mean, it's what brings most of us together. I mean, it has given me a really lovely career, which has been amazing. But ultimately, it's about meeting people. I mean, I had dinner with Jamie the other night at a place that neither of us had eaten at. And I love watching him, the way he analyses every flavour and every, again, the minutiae of every dish, and is constantly inspired. Mm. And, you know, I'm inspired by art and music and all sorts. He's inspired by food. Mm. And ultimately, food is nature, and anything that I do is somehow related to it, whether it's, you know, reportage or travel or whatever. So I feel very blessed with what I get to do and who I get to follow. And
the similarities that you've just said between you and Jamie, how you're very detail-orientated, do you think that is, in some ways, the secret to being very successful at something? You have to really care about the details.
Maybe, yeah. I think it's also that always knowing that you need to learn. Mm. I think that really helps. And Jamie and I are in the same boat there. Massive imposter syndrome helps because, of course, you always strive to be better. Mm. I mean, you know, if someone asked me to analyse my own photography, I'm writing a book at the moment about my photography, and the biggest problem of writing about my own work is I don't rate it.
Do you really so, not? Because no, I read that no, in so many interviews. But no, David, how can that be true?
So that means, as a result, I'm very self-critical. But also, of course, pointing out the flaws in one's own work hopefully teaches other people, again, to be better at photography. I mean, I can point out that I judge the Pink Lady Awards every year. Mm. And, you know, the photography I see there sometimes is so sublime, so gorgeous and risky and, you know, out there and amazing. And I'm just constantly blown away by people's talent and sort of, you know, the searching. The person who was part of the group that named me 65th, he was a picture editor at the Times, and he said I had a very hungry eye, which I always thought was rather sweet way of looking at her. Mm. And it's true, it's hungry eyes.
Yeah, I read that. So what exactly did he mean by hungry eyes?
I think it's that always searching, always wanting to learn. I kind of go through life, I see everything as a sort of golden rectangle, really. So when I look at a room, as I look at you now, I'm looking at the best angle, I'm looking at the best light.
I hope you are, David.
Yes, you are. You're both bathed in glorious light. But, you know, I see beauty in most things. Mm. Quite often I'm sent into quite dangerous situations, and whether it's, I don't know, gangs in LA or fishermen out at sea, and even when the scene is ugly, I mean ugly and mean and horrid, you know, I'm trying to find a pretty picture. Mm. I mean, I'm sure most photojournalists think my work is probably too pretty. I'm probably too commercial for most sort of art photographers or...
I've never heard anyone say that. Well,
well, you know, I'm still trying to find the beauty. I mean, I was writing about the gangs of LA the other day, and, you know, I spent several days with the Bloods, and it was brutal, brutal, cruel, you know, and it was machine guns and people being shot, and it was nasty. It was really nasty. And I did the same in New Orleans.
When you say you spent time with them, meaning they were happy for you to be there.
Yeah, so I was there as part of a team with Channel 4. Mm. So it was around Jamie's American series. So it's things like a gang christening or an after funeral event with, you know, jazz band stuff. I was actually attacked at that event quite badly and knocked unconscious.
Why?
For being there.
With a camera.
Partly because I was white in a very impoverished post-Hurricane Katrina world with a camera. Mm. But it was terrifying. I mean, really terrifying. But still, there's a picture I took a few seconds before I was knocked unconscious. It's really pretty.
Is it?
And it's actually the person that knocked me unconscious.
Oh, my goodness.
So I'm not very good at doing ugly.
That's so interesting. There is beauty in every situation.
Yeah.
We're going to have to pause there. And a very unnatural segue, David, we're going to talk about the second desert island dish. What was the first dish you learned to cook?
So my mother taught me how to make spaghetti bolognese, which I think is one of... Some sort of spaghetti dish is one of life's must-know hacks.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can romance with spaghetti. Mm. You can break up with someone with spaghetti.
Oh, no, you must never break up with someone over spaghetti.
You know what I mean.
The Lady and the Tramp style.
Yeah, exactly. You cut the spaghetti off and it falls and they know it's all over. My dog actually occasionally, I've got a little toy poodle called Digby, and sometimes he does the Lady and the Tramp with me with spaghetti bolognese. And he sucks in the spaghetti, it's so sweet.
David,
I mean,
we
obviously
need a video.
I break off at the last minute.
Obviously.
Because, you know, one shouldn't really kiss a dog's nose. But so it was either spaghetti bolognese, and it was a great recipe, and I haven't changed it at all. I think I probably add red wine now, I know I add red wine, which I don't think I did when I learned it at the age of 8.
Yeah, understand.
The other thing might have been coconut ice. I learned them both at the same time, which I probably haven't made since. But you know the coconut ice, which is half pink, half white?
Oh, yes. I hadn't thought about that.
That
for
was
ages.
Such a childhood memory.
So incredibly sweet.
But yeah, so I learned main course and dessert at the same time.
Perfect. So what was your mum's secret to the best bolognese?
You know, I don't think it was any great secret. It was just a classic. You know, it was lots of onions and celery and tomato. Tomato, obviously, but carrot at the beginning. And then lots of tomatoes. Lots of veg, actually, in hindsight. Mm. My father always had a dicky heart, so she was always pumping the veg.
Okay.
And using good quality meat. Mm. But as a result, we ate quite healthily growing up, which was really good.
I mean, you've now spent thousands of hours in the company of these amazing chefs. Do you think that has rubbed off on your own cooking at home?
Definitely. Absolutely. I mean, I probably shouldn't say this as a photographer of cookbooks, but I've never actually done a recipe from a cookbook.
Have you really never?
No.
I mean, I've heard people say that before, but I wasn't expecting you to say that.
No, I look at the pictures and I read bits, but some cookbooks, you know, like Jeremy Lee, or, you know, they need to be read because they're so witty and charming. But no, I've never done a recipe from a cookbook. So,
although I think maybe that's fair enough, because the other people that tend to say that are recipe writers. If you're a recipe writer, it's then very hard to follow a recipe. And so I guess the same wisdom applies to you, that you're part of creating these beautiful books. And so it kind of stands to reason that you wouldn't then use them.
I mean, I'm a very restless photographer, so I don't stand around and do nothing. Okay. So I shoot reportage while things are being cooked. So as a result, I get the full recipe. But, you know, you think Jamie Oliver, I've shot almost every dish he's ever invented. So my knowledge of cooking is okay. You know, most of it's gone in and stayed in there. So Gennaro has probably taught me every pasta dish I can think of. Chris Bianco, best pizza chef in the world, you know, sitting with him in Phoenix, Arizona, being made pizzas, it's amazing. You know? So any dish that I make has some relevance to something I've done in the past. And it's just to remind oneself after a very busy day.
Yep, that's...
And the brain is... And it's, of course, it's normally at nighttime when you've had a very long day.
It was your father, really, I believe, who began your love affair with photography when he gave you a camera for Christmas. But I don't think you instantly took to it. Is that right?
No, I didn't. Sadly, the first photo I ever took, because it was Christmas, the weather was particularly pants, so it was rainy and grey and miserable. And we walked up the road to the Oaks, which is in Cushorn Beaches, where we ended up growing up, having moved out of London. My mother was a doctor there, and my mother was on call Christmas Day, so it was a bit of a sad Christmas Day anyway. So we all went up to the Oaks, and my sister was riding her bicycle through the woods, and I thought I'd take a picture of her riding towards me with my new Olympus trip. And the following week, when I got the film back from the chemist, which, you know, it took a week, you'd get it back, I couldn't believe they were all blurred.
So
it made me utterly miserable. I thought my father insisted I should learn black and white first, so black and white on a grey, miserable day of a moving sister on a bicycle. Just, it was hopeless. But then my father started buying me these. He retired 20 years before my mother. So he was 20 years older than my mother.
Okay.
And he retired early with his dicky heart. He was a broker in the city. And he used to wander down to a little local bookshop called Redding's, and he would buy me these very arty photography books. They're called Camera. And the photos were either quite erotic, which always surprised me as a young man, often black and almost always black and white, actually, and quite often blurry.
On purpose.
And it did make me realise actually blur was okay.
So it wasn't just a casual gift of a camera. It sounds like your father, he was really thinking this through and thinking this could be something that you would really enjoy.
I think so. I mean, he was slightly worried that I didn't have as many hobbies as my twin.
Okay.
But again, it was that thing. My twin had this thing of, he painted Napoleonic soldiers from a very young age.
Oh, did he?
I mean, I don't know why. I have no idea why. But so, again, it was that thing of being different. My father was definitely worried that I didn't have enough hobbies.
Okay.
So I think he bought the camera for that reason. And it worked.
Yeah, he knew. You studied graphic design at Chelsea School of Art, and the story goes that you had quite a horrible time with some of the tutors there. And it was really a case of trying to get away from them that led you to photography, because you could spend so much time in the dark room. Is that really how it went?
It is, yeah. I was utterly miserable there. I had some very sweet friends. John was at Kingston, which was far more commercial, and he was doing graphic design with illustration. I was doing graphic design with illustration. Mm. His was far more, you know, pushing you up and nurturing you. Mine was graphic design is for losers. And you need to paint like a German expressionist, bigger, more abstract, the better. Get yourself serially covered in muck. And I was, you know, I was this sort of kind of closet miniaturist doing these little detailed drawings. And so at the end of the second year, my head of department turned around to me and said, "David, you remind me very much of my daughter. She always wanted to be something she never would be."
What do you mean?
That's the end of my second year. So you think I've only got 1 year left to try and do something with my life.
Why would they say that?
I know, it's like, it's bullying, isn't it, really?
Have you ever seen them since?
No, funny enough, I was asked to do, because of course I turned out to be a success. Mm. I was asked to speak at her memorial service. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. But you have to accept that I will say exactly what she said to me. So, of course, I never heard from them again.
Oh, my goodness. I can't believe they asked you. That's outrageous.
It's so funny.
Oh, you know, she was dining off the fact that she taught you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure.
But what a horrible thing to
but
say.
No, it was pretty horrible. I actually applied to go to Kingston to join John after my second year. And Kingston said, absolutely, I could come. But I spoke to my parents, and quite rightly, they said, just see it out and somehow we'll make it all work. But I hid in the dark room for a long time. The pub and the dark room were my sort of solaces, I'm afraid.
No, but it is funny how life happens, isn't it, that something like that led to you discovering this real talent for photography, which, you know, you probably would have ended up getting there anyway.
Yeah, but it has meant my wine drinking, probably. So it's, wine and photography are both a result of bullying at art college.
Let's pause there and talk about the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
It's a really tough one, isn't it? So I work with this wonderful bunch of beardies in the Sussex countryside. They're in Firle and hunter-gatherer cook, and they're foragers, and they all work with live fire. They're amazing. And hunter-gatherer cook is also a truffle hunter. And he has this little half-blind dog called B-Dog Western that he taught to truffle hunt with a tennis ball, which he covered in truffle oil.
Oh, wow.
And he would hide it. And he taught B-Dog Western to be a truffle hunter. And it turns out in some bits of Sussex, the chalky soil, you get a lot of truffles.
Oh, wow, I didn't know
so
that.
So he goes truffle hunting, and he then cooks in a barn, and they teach people about foraging and butchery and things like that. They're amazing. And Chris, who is T-Bone Chops, will then use those truffles in some of his dishes. And he always worries about me, thinks I need feeding, and worries that I don't eat during shoots, which I don't. I just keep going, really. And he did once make me the most extraordinary scrambled eggs with Burford Browns, truffles, no oil, just amazing little sort of, Jamie would always call them these little sort of flavour bombs of cheese in the scrambled egg. On some amazing sourdough toast, which was made by possibly the best baker in the world, a guy called David Wright, who's now at Pump Street. And so you imagine this sort of perfect sourdough, cultured butter, you know, the most amazing eggs, little flavour bombs of cheese, and then a lot of black truffles on top, which have just been found by B-Dog Western.
B-Dog Western.
That might be... I mean, if the asteroid was heading to Earth and was about there in the sky, and I had to eat something just before I I pop my cogs, I'd probably say that would be the best thing I've ever eaten.
I think I'm going to have to join you for that one. That sounds absolutely gorgeous. Truffle. Why is truffle so delicious?
Yeah, it's...
I'm moving to Sussex.
I think the problem, people who don't like truffles are because they've had truffle oil, which I think is a ghastly invention. Mm. But proper truffles, so freshly grated.
Yeah, so much more delicate than the oil.
Oh, yeah, it's the delicacy that's amazing. Also, they look unbelievable. I mean, I could photograph truffles forever.
Yeah, it's almost like a black diamond kind of.
Yeah,
like
amazing.
It was the illustrative side of graphic design that you really loved. So you initially worked as an illustrator, but it was a desire to get out of the studio that led you to photography. And I think you are quite unusual in the sense that you do so many different types of photography. When you were starting out, did people want to pigeonhole you?
You do, and most photographers do get pigeonholed quite early. Mm. I think because I just abandoned illustration overnight and became a photographer, I had no understanding of the way the hierarchy worked or the way, you know, you had to be an assistant for a couple of years and you either went into food photography or fashion photography. So I just did it all.
Okay.
I just assumed that's what people did. So I would do a fashion test one day, then I'd photograph a friend in his interior or her interior just to practice. Then I went to Kew Gardens and photographed the architecture there and the flora and fauna, and that was my initial portfolio. And when I first took my portfolio out, I took it to three places, my first three meetings with my fresh photographic portfolio, and I was rejected by the first two people.
Oh.
And they were really rude. So I nearly cancelled the third, which was on the same day.
Rude how? Why?
Oh, World of Interiors told me they took the piss out of my shoes for the first thing.
Oh, what?
I know. It's like,
that is rude.
In fact, Rupert Thomas, who was then one of the junior editors there, he's Alan Bennett's partner. And he'd seen me as a favour. I knew him a little bit, and he has since apologised for taking the piss out of my shoes at my first meeting.
What shoes were you wearing?
I can't even remember. I think I was wearing monkey boots. I was a bit of a punk at the time. So I think I was probably wearing monkey boots. But he did explain that I couldn't come into Condé Nast wearing monkey boots. and then the second one just said that I was doing too many different things. He was totally confused by my portfolio. The third one was Gardens Illustrated, and they saw a picture I'd taken and said, "We've just rejected a cover. It's Friday afternoon, and we need to commission a new cover on Monday, but it's got to be done by Tuesday to hit the presses. And it's a picture of some anemones." But it was Claudia Zeff, who'd been art director at Penguin and knew me as an illustrator, and she said, "If you come in with a picture of anemones that looks good enough, it'll go on the cover."
That's huge.
So I spent the weekend sweating buckets trying to find anemones, and then that she wanted them with a sort of landscape which looked post 7 p.m., the sort of magic hour.
Great.
of sort of bluey light and anemones, and but the feeling that there's a landscape behind, but you can't quite see it. And, of course, the weather was terrible that weekend. So I did it in my front room. And being an illustrator, of course, I just painted the background and had it out of focus.
Oh, perfect.
So she always thought I'd shot it on a horizon, but actually I painted it.
Oh, perfect.
Which
just shows there are no rules.
But I shot 40 rolls of film. I was so
to get
determined
the one shot.
To get it right. Yeah. I had this old Hasselblad, and so it cost me way over the amount I was eventually paid. And I was so frightened of taking it into Claudia Zeff that I put all the film in a plastic bag and hung it on the door of John Brown Publishing, rang the bell and
there.
Ran. And I rang at 5 o'clock in the afternoon because I hadn't heard anything. And I said to her, "Look, I'm really sorry I couldn't face seeing you, but I left it on the door. I hope you found it. I assume it's no good as you haven't called or anything." She went, "Oh, no, it's gone off to press."
She said, "Why hadn't she called?"
And we'd love you to shoot our next cover and the next one after that if you can.
Oh.
And by the way, there's an assignment to shoot a gardener. So initially I was a garden photographer.
Wow. I love stories like that. You just need one person to just give you a chance. And when you get those early wins almost when you're starting out, I think that's really important because without them, it's kind of hard to keep the motivation. Oh, yeah. You need signs that you're on the right path, don't
you? Yeah, and it was funny. There were just these very quiet people who would just keep me buoyed. Mm. I mean, Joan Tinney, who was at Cosmopolitan, phoned me one day and she said, "Have you ever shop food?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Do you think you could shoot food a bit like you shoot your flowers?" And I said, "Yeah, I assume so." She said, "Brilliant. I'd like to offer you a little column in the Cosmopolitan with a guy called Richard Ehrlich, who's this funny little American man. It's really, really sweet." He turned up at my studio, which was my front room, where I shot all the food on a drawing board, resting on an armchair with a reflector made out of tinfoil.
Which I know you got that from the Blue Peter studio.
I did.
Let's pause there and talk about the fourth Desert Island dish. David, what is your favourite sandwich?
Well, sandwiches are tricky for me because I'm celiac. Okay. And I was diagnosed a year before lockdown.
Oh, right. Okay.
So bread I struggle with. Mm. And as I told you about David Wright, and he's coming up with the perfect bread for me.
Amazing.
Because gluten-free bread is hopeless. Mm. Robin Gill makes a nice one at Darby's. And Sally Clark makes a nice seeded, a really good seeded loaf. But, you know, seeded loaves can be very dense. Mm. But she makes a great one. Trouble is she doesn't make enough for the whole of London celiacs. And so, where I live in sort of Chelsea Battersea, celiacism, if there's such a word, is very popular.
Okay.
In fact, in one of my favourite restaurants, there's a very, very sweet waiter. And I'm allergic to chilli, so I've never been able to eat chilli.
What happens?
And it's anaphylactic.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay.
I think it's me and Paul Smith, the two.
Yeah, I've never heard that before.
Two chili allergies. And so my wife quite rightly reminded me to tell every waiter, "Look, I'm really sorry, I'm celiac." So in the early days, I said to the waiter, "Oh, I have to tell you my new allergy. I'm afraid I'm celiac." And he said, "Oh, darling, 90% of Chelsea is celiac."
So when you say that you were only diagnosed with it just before lockdown, have you always been celiac?
Yes.
You just didn't know it?
Yes.
Wow.
So a lifetime of being quietly poorly, particularly when I'm travelling, particularly in Morocco where I go a lot, and it turned out it was the couscous. And of course, when you're poorly, you think, "Oh, I'll eat something simple." And I would say, "I'll have a simple couscous."
Mm.
And it was debilitating. It really was. But when I eventually told my mother and my doctor at the same time, they, of course, tested me for something much worse, which at my age, they're sort of saying, "Oh, this doesn't look good." So when, of course, the results came back and they'd removed little lumps and bumps and said, "Nothing wrong with you, but did you know you're celiac?" I promise you, I celebrated for weeks.
A huge relief.
So I kind of still am celebrating that,
You
know, I didn't have the big C, but I'm celiac. But David Wright's working on a recipe for the perfect loaf.
Okay, and then when that is
perfected. But what I would put in that loaf is the question. And the perfect sandwich, I mean, I do like a really good egg mayonnaise.
Mm.
I have to say, my childhood favourite was definitely egg mayonnaise.
Yeah.
As long as I'm not in a train carriage with egg mayonnaise. But
well, that's fine for you. It's
more
just bad for everybody
people.
Else. Yeah.
But a really good egg mayo is quite hard to beat.
Mm, really good. I think that's an excellent choice.
Mm.
One interview I read, you said that even now with your photography, you make a lot of mistakes, which I thought was a very generous thing to say, as I think people will take comfort in knowing that even the great David Loftus makes mistakes. And that also you only use one lens on your camera. Is that still true?
It is true.
Is that very unusual?
I do have more lenses, but they tend to gather dust.
Okay.
Part of it's for show.
Having lots of lenses.
Well, I have been criticised for turning up at shoots with too little equipment.
Okay.
I've also been told if I turn up at advertising shoots, I should bring a tripod.
I
shoot handheld.
Mm, I read that, and that you have to bring assistance even though you don't normally use
assistance.
Yeah,
I don't. I mean, I have a lovely lighting assistant, Ollie, who's a hoot. And Richard, who's my sort of digital assistant, Richard Boyer, who's fantastic. And I take him on Jamie shoots mainly to feed him up. but also because he cannot believe that he is on a Jamie Oliver shoot being cooked for and fed. And he's a fellow Essex boy, and Jamie literally doesn't leave him alone.
Oh.
And is constantly, you know, Jamie's a teaser and a ribber, you know. So Richard, being a fellow Essex boy, is perfect. And he's constantly feeding Richard. And I love to see that. And obviously Jamie cooks a lot of chili, so he can use Richard as my sort of foil, really.
Okay, perfect.
David can't eat this, give it to Richard. And Richard's as skinny as a rake, so feed up Richard. But I do bring a tripod sometimes, but quite often the camera just comes off it and it just, again, it sits in the corner. But I'm a bit of a one-lens wonder, yeah.
And you've been known to say that if you can see, you're a photographer, and that most people can take a decent picture. Mm. But I wanted to ask, what takes a photo from decent to really very good?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, a lot of those amateurs don't have the bravery to go professional, but they'd love to.
Okay.
And of course they could. There's work for everyone, really. I mean, mobile phones have proven that most people can be a photographer, and seeing what people do with their phones is extraordinary.
Amazing. Bon Appetit shot a whole issue, didn't they?
Yeah, exactly. So everyone can do it. I think it's just following a few little rules.
Mm.
And light is always a problem. A lot of photography is very dark, and I've noticed that. And I always wonder, you'll see it in a restaurant or in day-to-day life. People will go and take a photograph of some food. And I always think, just walk 6 foot to your right or left. There's a window.
Mm.
You know, just a bit of daylight will lift your...
Yeah.
Photography.
I have to say, David, I'm always so grateful when I see that you've liked one of my pictures on Instagram, but I also feel so stressed thinking about what you... I think you're liking it to be very kind and nice,
your filming's good as well. And again, it's the minutiae. You focus on the minutiae, which I think is the key as well. But I think the law of thirds helps everyone.
Okay.
So always think of things in thirds.
Yeah.
As I said, my brain kind of works in a sort of golden rectangle,
mm-hmm.
and then divided into thirds. So if you shoot a landscape, make sure your horizon is straight. That's a real bugbear. And then, you know, two-thirds sky, one-third sea or landscape, or two-thirds landscape and sea and one-third sky. But if you think of that with food... It works exactly the same, or a portrait or anything. If you get your angle straight and think of the law of thirds, you're...
More than halfway there.
More than halfway there, yeah.
We're on to the fifth desert island dish. What's the dish you eat the most often?
The one I order most often is probably oysters.
Ooh.
I'm obsessed with oysters. In fact, I had some last night.
Oh, you did?
And there's a new Noma Projects... have decided that I've obviously gone on Rene's mailing list, which is lovely, and they've sent me these new vinegars.
Ooh.
And there's a forager's vinegar. It's unbelievable. It's like something I've never tasted before. And I put it on some oysters and shucked oysters last night for the first time.
Oh, wow.
And Charlie Bigham sent them for our birthday, sent my birthday. So he sent me this big old thing of oysters and shucked them all last night. We had them with forager's vinegar on.
Oh, wow.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, that's
so good.
That sounds incredible.
But my kind of signature dish is clams.
Mm.
And I change it, again, because I don't have a recipe, I change it depending on what I have. But it's essentially, I go walk up to Chelsea Fish with the dog and ask for clams, so the big juicy clams. And the fisherman always gets out about, I don't know, half a kilo of clams and goes, any more? And I say, oh, yes, double that, make it a kilo. And so he does a kilo.
Well, yeah, because it's mainly shell.
Yeah, so he does a kilo of clams. He looks at me slightly puzzled, a kilo? And I say, actually, a kilo and a handful. So now I just go in and I ask for a kilo plus a handful of clams for two.
Sounds good.
And then I slow cook, you know, the big white onions, the lovely big juicy onions, those, garlic, white wine, lots of cherry tomatoes, and a tin of those lovely mooty cherry tomatoes, the sweet ones. chuck those in, and then just a whole bunch of parsley, all the stalks, everything, all that goes in, and some wine, obviously, and clams, all the clams in. Honestly, it's bliss. Good oil.
Do you ever toss them through pasta, or you just have them as they are?
Oh, no, I also put in those lovely white beans, you know, the jarred white beans. So yeah. Haricot beans, so no pasta.
Okay.
Ooh. Haricot beans. Ooh. Or the big butter beans, if they're, depending what's in the cupboard.
David, that sounds absolutely delicious.
And that makes it really sort of, the beans make it really creamy.
Mm.
I mean, you don't need anything else. And because there's so many clams, you're never hungry. You know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
It's bliss. Yeah. So that's my invention.
That sounds really good. I'm going to have to recreate that. You've now shot well over 30 books with Jamie Oliver and more than 30 million copies in book sales, which is absolutely incredible. I wondered, how did your friendship begin? Was it through work, or did you know each other before? And when you first worked together, did either of you have any inkling of what lay ahead of both of you?
I was first sent to photograph him by the Saturday Times. Mm. And it was really sweet. The Saturday Times then was really, it was the sort of prettiest of those Saturday magazines. I mean, still, it's still a great magazine, but it had a very sort of forward-thinking picture editor. And they were doing a summer bumper issue. And they had shot a feature of me living, I was living on a houseboat in Chelsea, and they did this sort of centerfold thing. They said they were hoping to get a cover out of it, which I thought, oh, that would be nice for my career.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's me on the boat with my then very, very young son. I think he must have been 9 months.
Oh, wow.
So on the boat, and I was thinking, oh, it'd be great if that went on the cover. And then they said, actually, we'd like you to shoot most of the issues. So there was another interior shoot. So I shot the rest of the thing. And then I got this call, and it was a real mixed blessing. They said, we've changed our mind about the cover. And I was like, oh, great. And they said, yeah, this hot young chef is bringing out a book called The Naked Chef. Oh, really? And they said, can you go and shoot him on a rooftop in the city? We've hired this apartment, and he's turning up at 2 p.m. He's going to cook a little barbecue for four friends. And we just need a great sort of reportage-y portrait of him, plus get the dishes if you can and some pictures of the friends entertaining him. Okay. So off I went at 2 o'clock, beautiful apartment. 7 p.m. he turned up. Turned out that no one had actually communicated with Jamie that this was quite a big deal. And he was just doing his shift at the River Cafe. He was 5 hours late because he was doing his shift at the River Cafe. So he was doing the lunch shift. So he turned up. There was no barbecue that he liked at the location on the rooftop. So he ran downstairs, found some rubbish from a skip, came back up to this really chic modern apartment, built a barbecue out of tires and pieces of wood. I mean, it's very Jamie. And proceeded to put on very loud music and cook a barbecue in the fading light.
Oh, my goodness.
He loves to tell the story because I had my old Hasselblad, which I shot on, and they're difficult to shoot on handheld anyway, but he was fascinated that that's what I did because he'd already shot a book. You know, he was thought he knew everything about a book shoot.
And
I'm winding away with a film. It's getting dark, and I was using daylight film, so I knew all the colours were going to go wacky.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no pre-digital, there's nothing you can do about it. So I was just winging it, basically.
That's
anyway, his
stressful.
Four friends turned up. It turned out it was 22 friends.
What?
Most of whom had come for a jolly and were half tiddly from the pub and various other places. So I thought it was a disaster, the shoot. He then phoned the Times the following day and complained that he barely saw me. But I was
trying to
cover everything. You know, I was trying to. Anyway, the Times said, you know, he's very respected, David Loftus. You know, you should go and check him out. Yeah, and he got the cover. And Jamie's like, oh, you know, and it was his first magazine cover. You know, he's probably had thousands since.
Yeah, that was the first one.
Again, it's slightly blurry. It's very blue because it's on daylight film and it's almost nighttime. So it's got a bluish tone again.
Were you pleased with it?
Not really. But then...
You never are. You
no, never. I'd have preferred... I did one in black and white, which I much prefer, but of course, okay. Black and white was far too... Anyway, it's a sweet picture, and he went to the bookshop the following day, and he found this series of four books by Alastair Hendy called Fresh In. So it was Fresh in Spring, Fresh in Summer, Fresh in Winter. And he left a message on my aunt's phone. He called me, and I just didn't feel like picking up the phone. So my aunt's phone went on, and he goes, and it was Jamie going, I am not worthy, I am not worthy, I am not worthy. And it was really sweet. He said, I've just bought your Alastair Hendy books. I'm really sorry.
I'd
love to work with you again. And yeah. Initially, I was just commissioned to do the cover of Return of the Naked Chef. But then while we were shooting the cover of Return of the Naked Chef, they said, actually, we'd love you to shoot the whole book.
Wow. And then I carried on. And that was the beginning.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And we became godparents to each other's kids.
It's so interesting to look back and think about how it all began and how first impressions aren't always right. And I don't know.
Well, he took on his first, Louise Holland, who partly runs his company now, he took on as an assistant. Mm. And we interviewed her at the Bluebird. And I said, Jamie, are you sure you need an assistant? It was madness, considering you think of the 7,000 people he's employed. I said, are you sure you need an assistant? He said, well, you've got one. I want one.
That's so funny. So when you first met him and he was building a barbecue out of the tyres, did you think immediately that he had it? Like, could you see what
he
the future...
He was so different to anyone I'd shot before. Mm. You know, I'd shot Gordon, I'd shot all these sort of highfalutin Michelin-starred chefs, and he was so different. You know, I'd seen a huge amount of bullying in the kitchen, which I couldn't bear, and I really began to question where I was going with my photography, and I definitely thought I didn't want to be around chefs as such. And, you know, he was cooking for friends. The staff at the River Cafe obviously adored him. He was chums with everyone from the pot washer to the head chef. He was so giving, so funny. I mean, people don't really understand how funny he is. He is one of the funniest people I've ever met.
Oh, really?
But, you know, in that sort of old school humour of just everything is hysterically funny.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe he was using this tiny little gas stove and, you know, cooking the most extraordinary food and still would be the same. He's one of the very few people, you know, with the weirdy beardies, and, you know, I'm lucky to work with people like Nicholas Ekstedt, who cook with live fire, but they're the people you want to be on a desert island with, you know, because they will literally just dig a tiny hole, make a fire, find something and cook it.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it's an amazing way to live, and they're definitely some of the best flavours through my career.
You work with very famous people, but you do also shoot first-time cookbooks. You shot The Roasting Tin when Rook Mini was an unknown writer, and it's gone on to sell millions of copies. When you get a job come in for a cookbook, what is it that will make you say yes?
I mean, I've always put it out there that I want to shoot first-time chefs.
Okay.
And of course,
why?
I'm incredibly loyal to the people I like, I'm so loyal to. I'm heartbroken when they go somewhere else, you know, on book two or book three. And often it's because they just want change
or want a female photographer.
It's heartbreaking. It's awful. Rook Mini's been incredibly loyal. And chefs can be a bit funny about Rook Mini. It's, you know, it's roasting tin. It's simple. It's for some, it's too easy. And it's almost, I think well-known chefs think it's almost like cheating. Mm. You know, it's like a hack. Or something. But actually, she's been one of the most influential chefs in my world. Mm. I mean,
it's how people cook at home.
Four times a week, I just throw all the vegetables I have into a roasting tin and throw in some beans and herbs and good oil. And I mean, and that's completely Rook Mini.
Yeah.
I've just started working with Giuseppe Sepps, who cooks with his nonna, vegan. I've just done Sam's Eats, which has been lovely. It's the passion, I guess, that I love, and that's a bit like the early Jamie passion. Yeah. Now, Jamie is exactly the same now as he was 22 years ago. The passion is as intense.
Mm. So do you get a pitch for a cookbook and you meet the person and then you decide if you're going to say yes?
So
and
with like, Giuseppe, do you I say met no? him and I have been known to say no.
Do you make up a very polite excuse?
Yeah, it hasn't happened very often, to be honest.
Okay.
What's really upsetting is when I hear from someone, Max LaManna. He was in Fortnum's recently and I was in there shooting. And the Fortnum staff came up and asked, would I mind shooting his portrait while he's there? And he came up, he's the sweetest, sweetest chap. And again, so passionate, so amazing. And, you know, all about everything I'm passionate about waste and, you know. And he said, oh, I was so sad you couldn't do my book. I looked at him and I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
And he said, yeah, apparently it didn't fit into your schedule.
Oh, no,
it's a bit like the speech at art college,
David.
Isn't it? I know. And
you've
I was like,
got to remember who you said no to.
Well, I didn't. That was the thing. I was never asked.
Oh.
I would never say to someone it didn't fit my schedule, but also to someone I was so passionate about.
But it was never put to you.
But it was never got to me. And I know what it's like. Publishers have friends who are photographers and loyalty to photographers. But it is upsetting when you hear somehow you've turned something down without even being asked. But it's very rare that I've tended to turn down people because I've known they're bullies.
Oh.
And there's a few people that I would definitely never work with again.
Oh,
and
really?
And that whole chefing world, that's where I saw some real horrors of bad behaviour. And I do think chefing still is going to, the chef world is going to have its big Me Too movement at some point. Because I've seen some terrible behaviour, and I couldn't be around it. So I have walked out of shoots before.
Have you?
As a result, yeah.
I like that. We need more David Loftus in the world. We're on to the sixth Desert Island dish. What's your go-to dinner party dish?
The last dinner party I had was about 2 weeks ago, and I did the clams. Mm. So the clam dish would be.
Yeah. Do you tend to serve a starter?
Well, now that in the last 3 days I've properly learned how to shuck an oyster without seriously damaging myself or the wooden surface at home or anything, I would definitely do oysters with the vinaigrette.
Mm. Do you throw many dinner parties?
I don't really, to be honest. I'm a great go-outer and I love restaurants. Because of my allergies and the things, I have old favourites that I've gone to for years and I still go to.
It's kind of easier to go to a restaurant than it is to a friend's house. Because...
Oh, some of the best times of my life have been in restaurants, really. You know, Carousel for my birthday the other night, I was thinking, this is one of the most magical moments of my life.
Wow.
Which is not bad at 60,
is
it?
Yeah, that's amazing.
You know.
And are you a pudding person?
I am a pudding person. I'm quite a simple pudding person. I mean, I'm quite happy with a bar of fruit and nut, if I'm really honest.
Nothing wrong with that.
But, you know, something like anything with figs in, anything with pistachios, a good pistachio ice cream is hard to beat. If I can have pistachio ice cream on a gluten-free fig tart, which is full of frangipani, served with a nice glass of rosé, that would probably be my ultimate.
That'd be very good.
Yeah.
This is going to be a very hard question for you, David. On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask you, what is your most treasured cookbook?
Actually, it's not the hardest thing. I have this little obsession, which I really wanted to make a film about Alexis Soyer. Do you know Alexis Soyer? So he was the head chef at the Reform Club in the 1840s, I think. And he was the first person, he invented the soup kitchen. Where it was the potato famine that started, I think. And he would go to impoverished areas and make soups and teach people. And he would write cookbooks. He was the first ever celebrity chef, essentially. And he would teach people how to make this soup. And it was called Poor Soup. And as a result, he started writing books. So writing books for the poor, but then he also needed to make some money, so he'd write Books for the Rich.
I think he needed some help with his branding. I'm not sure Paul.
He was a bigamist for one thing, which was not good for his branding. But he did go off. Florence Nightingale apparently hated him.
Oh.
But he did go off to the Crimea because he read that more people were dying from poor hygiene of nutrition than were from gunshot wounds.
Wow.
So he went off the Crimea and he invented a field stove called the Sawyer stove.
Wow.
And they still use it in the army today. And it changed the course of the Crimean War.
Wow.
I think Florence Nightingale was equally publicity sort of aware.
Yeah.
They were the two celebrities of their age in the Crimea.
Yeah.
And they fought a bit, apparently.
That's
I always wanted to make a film of him. But at the same time, I was also obsessed with Alexander Dumas.
Mm.
And I always thought you know, if I was going to sit down and have my sort of final dinner with celebrities from the past,
yeah.
I always thought I'd have Alexis Sawyer doing the cooking on his little Sawyer stove, and I'd have Dumas writing about it and talking about he wrote the best book I've ever read, which is The Count of Monte Cristo,
mm-hmm.
and it's a story of revenge, and I quite like revenge. I know it's really like un-PC to like revenge, but perfect revenge is quite cool. And a lot of people have wronged me in life, so I feel, you know,
feel
perfect
like
revenge. So I have Dumas, but he wrote a cookbook. So not a lot of people knew it.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he wrote the perfect French cookbook. And
did he really?
Yeah. So everyone reads the Three Musketeers and stuff, but he actually wrote a cookbook.
That's so
And I always thought it'd be quite nice to republish it, but with photos.
Mm.
So between Sawyer and Dumas.
Yes.
Does that all sound a bit abstract?
No, I love that. I can't get my head around lovely David Loftus.
Revenge.
I mean, I read about a guy at your art college who I think was very jealous of you and stole all of your final project and your camera.
He did.
And when you recounted that story, you were so lovely and unbothered and you know who it was.
You see,
you're not a revenge seeker.
Rebecca Frayn, who did a documentary about my twin and I for Channel 4, she always said, you know, I was like a swan. So it's quiet and graceful
okay,
on the top.
So you've got to watch out.
Underneath that water.
Okay.
But no, you know, Ange.
And it's best served cold.
Yeah,
so you're just biding your time.
You know, Ange tracked him down.
Yes, I know.
And got my father's camera off him.
Amazing.
I know, and gave it to me.
Was he sheepish?
I think he's probably in denial.
Okay.
But somehow he said, you know, he felt he should clear my stuff away because I wasn't there for some reason. You know, it's a long time ago.
Yeah, no. We don't hold grudges.
Well,
we're on to the final seventh desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
I would definitely start with my papaya with a squeeze of lime. Great thing about, of course, going off to actually a desert island, would I mind about the toiletry consequences of celiacness, I wonder?
Oh.
Yeah, so maybe if I'm on my own on the desert island.
That's a delicious thing to think
about.
I do apologise.
But, you know, us celiacs have to think like this.
No.
It's like the consequences are quite dire.
Yeah.
So you have to think whose company you're going to be in and where you're going to be.
Yeah.
Of course, desert island, I assume we're on our own.
You are.
We're on our own. So I'd definitely go for my papaya with lime. I'd follow it up with a good old loaf of sourdough.
Mm.
I'll be sick for a week, but hey. And
that
the truffles.
That will pass the time.
Actually, I might add another starter, equally sourdough, but with pickled herrings.
Ooh.
I love Swedish food, and they're so good for you.
Would you have a pudding before you go to the desert island?
It'd have to be the same as before. You see, it's just stick pistachios, figs. We have frangipani. Again,
yeah.
I can have real pastry
because
I'm going to be poorly anyway for a week or
yeah.
two. So some really nice buttery pastry.
Mm.
You know, where it's that thing where the frangipani meets pastry and there's that jamminess, maybe a fig jam in there.
Mm.
Jeremy King always used to make the always had the best desserts. He brought one back onto the menu once because Ange and I were so upset, and it was a prune tart.
Ooh.
So again, prunes, figs, that sort of word, dates, anything with dates.
So again,
it's all those things. That's what I'd throw it all at. Okay. I'd throw all those things into the same dessert, actually.
Well, with that, David Loftus, we're going to send you to the desert island. Thank you so much. Those were your desert island dishes.
Bless you. It's an absolute pleasure.
So there we have it, another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget that you can rate, review and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're listening. I think really you can rate it in some way, and it really does help others to find out about the podcast. It kind of boosts it in the charts and is just a very helpful thing, and reviews really do make all the difference. So thank you very much. If you don't already, you can come and follow me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, and you can sign up for the newsletter and also find a whole host of different recipes at desertislanddishes.co. Thank you very much again to our sponsor, HG Walter. We couldn't bring this to you without them, so very grateful for their support. And I will see you next week. Thank you so much for listening. Bye.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You have 5 new messages. Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week? Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.